You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Have you ever watched an apocalyptic sci-fi movie and wondered, could any of this really happen? I'm Carrie Bechet, and on Hypothetical, we explore what-if questions two ways, through speculative science fiction and through insight from the world's most brilliant scientists. And spoiler alert, your favorite sci-fi movies aren't nearly as far-fetched as you may think. Time travel with me into our possible futures on Hypothetical. New episodes every Tuesday, available on all podcast apps. That's Hypothetical, Hyperthetical.
Hi, I'm Justine Evers, and I am the only biracial, bisexual, rape survivor, recovering binge eater, alcoholic, military veteran. I didn't know anybody in recovery. I didn't know anybody who chose to be sober. And I thought something was wrong with me. Why couldn't I just drink like a normal person? Food was ultimately the first self-medication that I was using to numb the feelings and the trauma. I felt like I was only worthy of love if I were a size 2. I felt like everybody looked at me differently, people treated me differently. I didn't feel like I belonged anywhere. My experiences aren't as unique as I think. I just haven't been exposed to the people, and I need to find those people.
I'm probably one of the few people I know who still looks forward to my Sunday newspaper, not a digital copy that I read on my phone, but the real finger-staining, loud crinkling, section-by-section newspaper. The Sunday paper for me is a treat to be enjoyed while lounging in bed and sipping hot lemon water. So one day when we were going through all of the Only One stories that are being submitted to us, thank you for those, by the way, we love reading them. It was Scott's idea to record and release a few of them occasionally, but always on Sundays, and call them our Sunday edition. And because they're only 30 minutes long, our hope is that you can enjoy them while sipping your morning beverage, going for a walk, or even just enjoying a lazy Sunday at home. Please enjoy today's Sunday edition, and be sure to listen every Tuesday when we drop another brand new episode of The Only One in the Room. Justine Evers, hello. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Really well. Thank you for asking, and thank you for coming on to the show. And I had a little icebreaker question I wanted to ask you. Is it true that you cried in therapy because your body wanted to be vegan, but you didn't want to be a sober vegan?
This is very true.
Tell me about that.
Yes, I was drawn to being a vegan, and I just kept feeling like vegan foods are healthier for me. It's feeling better in my body, but I didn't like the stereotype that came with it. And so I was fighting every ounce of it. And I cried in therapy and I was like, but I don't want to be a vegan, let alone a sober vegan. It's like the worst stereotype. Like, how uncool am I?
Right, right.
Well, I feel your pain.
We are both sober vegans. So that's why I pulled that part out, because I thought that was really funny. And it's so true. It's like people are disappointed when you tell them that you're sober. It's like, oh, they're not going to be drinking. And then you say, oh, well, you know, I'm a plant-based eater. And they're like, oh, that's even more disappointing, because you're not going to share this steak with me. You're not going to taste my cheesecake, you know, after when we get dessert. It's like giving them two bits of disappointment to digest about you.
It is.
I honestly think people stop asking you out to dinner as much after after it's really sunk in.
Well, I agree.
It's true. It's true. I have a group of girls that we go out every 3 months probably, and they always forget I'm vegan. And so it's always like, let's go to blah, blah, blah steakhouse. And I'm like, is there anything there for me to eat? Question mark. And it, no, there's nothing there. We have to go someplace where Laura can eat.
I kind of feel like we're immediately not the cool person and no one wants to hang out with us.
Right. It's so true. It's so true. Thank you. Thank you for that. I laughed at that and I just had to ask you about it because I thought it was so funny. I am Laura Cathcart Robbins. This is the only one in the room, but I'm never the only one in this room because as usual, my boyfriend, producer, and co-host, Scott Slaughter, who I call Hun, is here as well.
Hi, honey.
Hey, Hun. So like I said, we are talking to sober vegan, Justine Evers. She is the author of Fuck This, Permission Granted to Own Your Story. She's a business consultant, an entrepreneur, and Navy veteran. And your identity is in the title of this episode, Justine, but is there anything that we didn't mention that is another way for you to identify?
Yeah, I have a new one. I've actually been in school for the last year and a half and working towards becoming a therapist in addiction. So
excellent.
Soon in 2023, I will be a substance abuse counselor.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Well, and thank you for mentioning that too. That's quite an accomplishment, especially having read some of your story to know that that's what you're doing now. I'm really happy that you're getting to do that. And you're a wife and the mother of three. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And you'll be 5 years sober on January 31st?
On February 1st.
On February 1st. Okay. Yeah. On February 1st. So pre-congratulations for that. I know we're not supposed to do that, but it's coming up very quickly. Actually, you know, when people are listening to this, it'll probably be like right around then. So that's great. You talk about alcohol being your first love and your best friend, saying that you loved brunch and traveling because drinking at brunch and at the airport were socially acceptable, right? Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
I mean, bottomless mimosas. That's all you have to say. I mean, it's like every alcoholic dream. It's like not frowned upon to drink bottomless mimosas. And I can drink them. I can somehow find the bottom before everybody leaves. And I think traveling, you know, I always notice people are drinking around the clock. For some reason, it's like not frowned upon to have a Bloody Mary or any drink of your choice at 8 a.m. Yeah. or 5 a.m. or, you know, it's not frowned upon to be at the bar waiting for your flight and no one questions it. So I always enjoyed traveling, especially for work, because I was typically alone and could not have to have anyone judging how much I'm drinking. So I really enjoyed sitting at the bar by myself and meeting other people who were doing the same thing I was doing. We always tend to find each other.
Yeah. And it's looking for those opportunities, right? Like it's almost a relief when you know, oh, it's brunch. So no one will be counting my drinks. No one will be saying it's too early or, oh, it's an airport bar. Mm-hmm. It's 9 a.m. and everybody's, you know, that thing is 9 a.m. or it's 6 o'clock somewhere, right?
Totally. And vacation. It's like, oh, I'm on vacation. I can have Bailey's in my coffee. It's okay. So yeah. I always loved those times because I felt like I could be my full self in those moments.
Absolutely. I was going to read a quote from your book. This is about getting sober. And you say, yes, I did it. I have finally asked for help. To be honest, I really didn't think I was capable of doing it. I instantly felt better and grateful for my loving husband who had the courage to tell me the truth. But seconds later, I felt embarrassed. I can't believe it. I'm an addict. Always have been, always will be. And I wonder if you could talk to me about the juxtaposition of those two, because those are two really big things, right? Right next to each other in the same paragraph of that feeling of surrender or admission, I guess. And then that shame spiral.
Yeah, I think I still have to admit that every day. But there's definitely less shame in that on a daily basis today. But in that moment, because I had my own stigma against an alcoholic and addict, I had my own stereotypes. And all of those stereotypes were running through my head. And I felt like a failure. I didn't know anybody in recovery. I didn't know anybody who chose to be sober. And I thought something was wrong with me. something was wrong with me. Why couldn't I just drink like a normal person? Why did I always have to overdo it? You know, why couldn't I control this like everyone else around me? And I just felt so ashamed of that. I didn't know that it was a disease. I thought it was absolutely in my control and I was failing.
Wow. Were you 34?
I was 34.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you said you had a respected reputation at work. Mm-hmm. As the founder and CEO of your first company, teaches military spouses, and we're going to talk about your time in the military too, but how to work anywhere in the world, right? But you said that none of it meant anything without alcohol. So tell me about that.
I mean, that business was built with my good friend Jameson right by my side. And I remember the first 6 months of that company filing all my paperwork and creating the name and building the website and, you know, getting the business cards, and all of it was done with an alcoholic drink in my hand. And it helped me through the anxiety of that entire process. And I didn't think I was capable of going out and raising money and traveling and asking for donations and speaking in front of people without a few drinks in me. I just didn't think it was possible. I lived in San Francisco at the time and, you know, staying up late, networking with BCs around the table, that was glamorized to me. That's what I thought the goal was. And then when I had arrived to it, I realized how miserable I was.
Right. So alcohol was getting in your way?
Mm-hmm.
Like, why did you stop drinking?
My marriage was falling apart. And, I wasn't ready to lose that. That for me was my bottom. And along with a lot of embarrassing nights of having to explain my actions away and justifying a lot of inappropriate behavior, a lot of hangovers and calling out of work to nurse myself back to health. And but ultimately, it came down to my marriage. I was not ready to leave that. And I was provided an opportunity to get help. And when I saw that look in my husband's face of fear and worry, it scared me, because I knew in that moment I was on the verge of losing my husband and my kids, and that I didn't want that. And I feel really grateful that something clicked, because it doesn't always click for people in that moment. So I feel really lucky. Yeah, I feel really lucky. And I don't know how or why I got so lucky to have it work out that way. But I don't take it for granted, for sure.
Mm. Now, I love that. I think of it for myself like a moment of grace that I was able to step through.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have an explanation for it, just like you're saying. I couldn't tell you why then, but it was like you. I don't take it for granted either. I'm extremely grateful for it. And I think it's really beautiful that, because a lot of people just bulldoze right through their marriages, that you really wanted to hold on to that. And we're able to have that moment that allowed you to see that through.
Yeah.
And to put down something that had been your companion for so long and been a source of comfort to you, right?
Absolutely. And I think to that point, I think I can admit that I loved alcohol more than anything in the world, including, I thought, my marriage. But clearly my actions showed that, you know, I loved my marriage and my children. You know, in that moment, I was willing to sacrifice that. But again, there's so many people that don't, and that doesn't mean that they don't love their spouses or their children. It just means, honestly, I don't know what it means. And I've been studying addiction for a year and a half now, and it's just that moment of grace.
Yes. Yes. So I want to talk a little bit about, like I said, your time in the military, because I definitely wanted to touch on that. You joined the Navy at 17, that's right?
I did. Mm-hmm.
And then you talked in your book about getting down to a size 2 after boot camp. What size were you before you got down to a size 2?
14, 16, around that.
So that's a dramatic weight loss.
Huge.
Yeah. And you talked about loving the attention you got in that new body. Can you talk to me a little bit about what that transformation was like, and then what it felt like to get that kind of attention?
It felt like a high. To be honest with you, it felt like a drug. I wanted more and more of it. And I felt like I was only worthy of love if I were a size 2. I felt like everybody looked at me differently. People treated me differently. men and women looked at me differently. They were more interested in dating me for sure. Mm. I felt respected. And that was something that I hadn't really experienced before that. Like my voice was heard in a way. And that's a weird thing to say. But I think for those that are listening that can relate to that will understand. I didn't feel like I was seen. And it's interesting because now I'm a size 12 today. I've gained weight since starting some medication over the last 2 years. And I'm battling those same thoughts of what it used to be like versus what it's like now. But learning to love myself at no matter what size I am, I should be loving myself at the same level, no matter what size I am.
We're going to take just a quick break to tell you about a cool new product that Scott and I discovered. And we'll get back to our guest's amazing Only One story in just a minute.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
Well, it's really interesting that you said that you felt like your voice was heard and respected as a thinner person. Were you conscious of feeling disrespected and unheard when you were larger? Or did you just notice it when you got thinner?
I just noticed it when I got thinner. For sure.
So you didn't know that you weren't being heard or seen the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Until all that attention came.
And
then gaining weight again and watching the tables turn again, because my weight has gone up and down my whole life.
Right.
And so now being a size 2 and then being a size 12, 14 again, watching the tables shift and then getting back down to a size 4 and then seeing, you know, so I've seen how the world reacts to different bodies. It's a weird experience. And it really feeds into that negative self-talk.
Well, and I think there's like a misconception that someone who is well, like their relationship, what they have, if they have a good relationship or a healthy relationship with food, that they're going to be a certain size. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't necessarily, like for someone who's in their addiction, you know, eating healthy can just mean that your relationship with food is not obsessive compulsive, right? Et cetera, et cetera. You wrote that all you wanted to do was be left alone with a bag full of McDonald's and of course, sweet and sour dipping sauce. Mm-hmm. My question is, how similar was this relationship that you have with food to your relationship with alcohol when you were using?
Totally the same. Totally the same. And it's interesting that you started off saying that alcohol was my first love, because what I've learned in recovery over the years is that I think food was my first love. I think I've learned that food was ultimately the first self-medication that I was using to numb the feelings and the trauma and just all of the emotion that I was feeling and wasn't able to get out in some way, shape, or form. So I think I was using food. But I found the two of them and started abusing the two of them right around the same time. So it felt very blurred for me. I couldn't really remember what came first. And since I've been in recovery, I've had a lot of memories come back. And I would say today I can see clearly that food was first.
Yeah. I hear that a lot, actually. Mm-hmm. And that thing where people discover that in recovery, when mm-hmm. they're like tracing back the times where there was self-harm with substances, mm-hmm. you know, or soothing with substances, which yeah. for most people starts with food.
Yeah. And I abused it. And I did for so many years. And then I would, you know, binge and purge and became a workout Nazi, figuring if I could just work out and run as many marathons and I could drink and eat as much as possible, because I would have achieved something to be as thin as possible or as strong as possible to justify my true feelings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's your relationship with food now?
So my relationship with food, it's been my main focus this fifth year in recovery. And I would say it's in a good place right now. I'm still very much, I still fail, still fall, as I would say, I still relapse with food, but I'm having more good days than bad. And when I say good, it means that I'm eating things in a portion, a healthy portion. I'm still eating the cake, but I'm not mm-hmm. eating the whole cake, you know.
Right.
I'm indulging in things that I love, but not overdoing it. I'm listening to my body, listening to my brain. I'm not eating things to punish myself. I'm not mm-hmm. overeating into where I'm sick and can't move. And I'm not purging in the way that I used to with laxatives or fitness. I'm working out to live as long as I can, to run around with my grandchildren and hopefully my great-grandchildren instead of trying to be as thin as possible.
Love that. I want to talk a little bit about being biracial mm-hmm. and being biracial, but presenting as white. So there's that great book, you know, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? Mm-hmm. Who did you sit with? And do you think it might've been easier in school for you if you presented as black?
I have to say yes, because I've always identified more with the black community, but I present white. And so until people got to know me, I didn't feel like I belonged anywhere. I usually sat by myself, or I found the random group of people that didn't tend to fit in anywhere. And that's mm-hmm. who I kind of gravitated towards and still tend to gravitate towards, where I feel the most welcomed is people who don't fit into a box. And, I think when you don't fit into a box, it makes others more uncomfortable than it makes us uncomfortable. And when I was a kid, I didn't understand that. I didn't understand that it was their fear, not mine. And I thought it was all me, you know. And when you're a kid, you want to fit in. And so I would have my lunch and, you know, look at the table there and not know where to sit. But what's interesting is that I didn't have that experience until I was in middle school, because I grew up in a predominantly black community. So I was, you know, looking at my skin, the only white person, but was biracial. But when I moved to Florida in middle school, it's very segregated. So I had a different experience. So it was very, very weird and challenging. But I found that I tend to fit in everywhere, but people have to get to know me. And there's a lot of judging that happens immediately because people don't know what to make of me.
I mean, that is prejudice, right? Is to prejudge somebody based on the way that they look or your perception of them. Mm-hmm. And most people can't get past that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll assess you as being this, this, and this, and then that's it. They're not interested in getting to know you further. I was really struck by that part of your book. Scott and I have talked about this a lot. Both my parents are black, but I was raised in like all white private schools, and we lived in a black neighborhood. And I don't remember feeling pulled one way or the other, but it was in high school where I realized that I had the culture and mannerisms of like one group of people but the skin color of another, and that they didn't mesh well. And then finding out how I could be myself wherever I was, and, you know, wanting to hang out with the cool kids, whoever those might have been, in any of the groups, which never happened. Never hung out with the cool kids. But I thought you wrote so well about that. And I think that people who also have that experience, who have children that have that experience, will really benefit from reading about it, because you explored it really gently. You had good perspective on it and were able to assess how you felt at the time. And then your perspective on it now was enlightening. So thank you for that part of it. And I wanted to talk to you about the other bi. First was biracial, now bisexual. And really my question around it is, if you can just talk about what happened when you told your mom that you liked girls as much as boys.
She wasn't very happy. She told me I was wrong and I didn't know what I was talking about.
You were how old?
I was in seventh grade. Seventh grade okay. was a hell
yeah, that was
week.
A critical time for you, right?
Critical time. Yeah.
Yeah.
And looking back, I definitely can see that when my drinking and eating food and all of that came into play. So, you know, I don't have a lot of memory about it. I just remember me telling her, being very scared to tell her reacting very negatively, telling me, I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm confused. And then the next flash I have is just us arguing and me running through the house and her taking a bulletin board off the wall and smashing it over my back, like a wrestling match. So I just learned very quickly that we don't talk about this. We won't talk about this ever again.
Did you have anybody in your life who did talk about it? Anybody that you knew of who talked about these feelings for different genders?
No. And I had no one in my life that talked about different races. Everyone was colorblind, didn't see color. Color didn't matter. No one had talked about racism. No. And I talk pretty vividly about a lot of run-ins with racism, and just never talked about it. And I didn't talk about it for a very long time until I was in my mid-20s. Maybe early 20s to my husband. And he was the only person that knew these experiences. And it really wasn't until I was 34, 35, 36 in recovery when I started to share these things and realize, A, I'm not alone, but B, these are really traumatizing experiences, and allowed myself to kind of feel that pain.
Yeah. I was just looking at your book cover, which anybody can find on Amazon. I mean, did you look to me like a Black woman on the cover?
You think so?
Was that your intention, or did you just want it to be yourself?
No, just wanted to be myself.
Yeah.
It was summertime.
Yeah, because when I looked it up, I'm like, oh, it's a sister. Okay. Like,
it's so funny you say that, because my experience has been, it depends on the person. Mm-hmm. It depends on the person who can tell if I'm biracial or not.
Yes, it does depend on the person.
It depends on the person. Some people know and they're like, what do you mean? Like, I've been in rooms where someone will ask me, you know, the topic of race will come up and someone will ask me, well, what are you? And I'll say it, and half the room will go, yeah, duh, I knew she was Black.
Right.
How could you not know? And the other half of the room will be shocked. Mm-hmm. And a quarter of that room will be what I feel, the feeling that I get is disappointed. And a lot of them will say, I just thought maybe you were from Brazil, or you were Spanish exotic in some way.
Yes.
And some would, but that disappointment is what I can't explain to many people, but I feel it, you know. And then they say, but oh, but you just talk so eloquently, and you are so professional. And I'm like, that's such bullshit.
Right. Right.
This is just like, do you hear what you're saying? And it's just happened so many times.
Yeah.
It's just pure ignorance, in my opinion. I don't even, unfortunately, it bothers me, but it happens so often to where I haven't given myself the space to really share what that makes me feel like. Mm. You know, I don't feel like I have the spaces or the people to really share that.
Well, and it's not always safe either for us to do that. It's not always safe. You know, we can speak up and should speak up, but there are some instances where as female identifying people, especially female identifying people of color, aren't safe to speak up and share their experiences. So, and that's a little bit of the final question I wanted to ask you was, you have all these different identities, including soon to be, tell me what you're going to be, something therapist.
Substance abuse counselor.
Substance abuse therapist. Thank you. How do you take care of all of you and the authentic you? Like what parts of your routine, your self-care routine, do you think are essential to that?
Morning meditation, lots of prayer, lots of meditation, lots of journaling, and I read a lot. I read a lot. I feel like the more I read, the larger my vocabulary becomes and the more tools I have to express the way that I've always felt, but never had the words to do it. So I'm just like a book nerd of all the things because I find that my experiences aren't as unique as I think. I just haven't been exposed to the people and I need to find those people.
Right. Right. Beautiful. Speaking of finding people, where can people find you?
People can find me at justineevers.com. They can also find me on probably Instagram is the easiest thing, at Justine Evers. The easiest way to find me is on Instagram.
Excellent. Excellent. And I really appreciate your answers to all these different questions about all these different parts of your identity in a relatively short period of time. You did really well. You did really well. I threw a lot at you. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
And another fantastic episode in the can.
I love our show.
I do too. And speaking of our show, we want to thank all of our Patreons for making it possible. And we'd like to welcome the new ones as well.
Welcome. And hun, explain how it is that our Patreons support our show and how folks can join our Patreon.
Sure. So we are an independent podcast, which means that there is no corporation behind us, which also means we have the freedom to bring you the stories that you want to hear.
Yes, which also means that we depend on you to keep producing these stories.
Right. And we really appreciate you. So basically to join, you just go to our website.
There's a link in our show notes of this episode to make it easy.
Then you follow the simple instructions. Also, there is a level for everybody. And after you join, you get access to all of our exclusive bonus content and special opportunities like monthly storytelling, which is a video series. We also do Zoom hangs. Please come hang with us. Monthly memberships start at $5 per month, not per day. That's per month. And the Zoom hangs are my favorite part. So which of our patrons are we shouting out today?
So today we're shouting out two of our favorites.
Right on.
Kelly Nishimoto of Cute Booty Lounge.
Right, Cute Booty.
Cute Booty was a concept that was born in Kelly's garage in 2004. She was looking to make pants that embrace a woman's curves and particularly the what, hun?
The booty.
The booty. Mm-hmm. But they were still polished enough to wear out and about. Her signature is her patented scrunch booty pockets. Cute Booty Lounge is made by women for women right here in the USA, actually right here in Los Angeles.
Right.
The company is incredible. It's female and minority owned. You just go to cutebooty.com in our show notes and order yours today. And what do people always say to me when I wear my leggings, hun?
Cute booty.
That's right.
We also want to thank Kathleen Hahn.
Kathleen.
Yes, a fantastic friend of the show from the beginning. We love your support and we are so appreciative of you.
Super grateful. Thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah, come join us on the Zoom hang.
Thank you so much for listening. The Only One in the Room is produced by the creative genius that is Scott Slaughter and edited by the uber talented polymath Christina Barcy and her team at Avon House Productions. Hey, you're still listening? Good. Please subscribe right now while you're thinking about it, quick, before you forget. And be sure to like and leave us a review of the show. Want to connect with some other Only One listeners? Be sure to join our private Only One in the Room Facebook group or check out Patreon on our website for exclusive content that you won't find anywhere else. And do you have an Only One in the Room story that you'd like to share? Please send it to theonlyonepod@gmail.com.
Have you ever watched a futuristic sci-fi movie and wondered, but wait, could any of this really happen? And will I live long enough to see it? That's what our show Hypothetical is about. I'm Carrie Bechet, and on this podcast, we ask what-if questions about the future. Like, what if we could read minds? What if the world's digital data was erased all at once? What would happen if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted? Then we explore that question two ways, through speculative science fiction and through dialogue with brilliant scientists. The result is a genre-bending narrative that's interwoven with real facts provided by literal geniuses. And spoiler alert, a lot of the science fiction out there, it's not nearly as far-fetched as you might think. Come time travel with me into the future on Hypothetical. New episodes on Tuesdays, available on all your favorite podcast apps. Just search Hypothetical. That's H-Y-P-E-R-T-H-E-T-I-C-A-L.